Morning, everyone, and welcome to a new series called Great Viktor Frankl Nuggets, which I'm going to explain in a moment. But before I do that, so as you all know, I had the great honor and privilege of being in Israel this past week. I still have a few days to have an excuse that anything I say that doesn't make sense is because of jet lag. But it was the most incredible, informative, and transformative trip and experience. Last night I shared a few things, and I'm going to share some today as well, because it fits in well with the topic of today's shiur anyway. But before we start, I just want to also point out that this is a new series, going to go towards the end of June. But in the middle, on the 12th of June, I think I mentioned this last time, but the 12th of June, we're going to just have a session, but it'll be a special event. We're going to have a guest, actually. His name is Levi Shmatkin, and he's the author of the book Letters for Life, which we used over two series. So he's actually going to be in Australia, so I thought it'd be great to have him here. I'm going to interview him and give us a better insight into the background of the book and so on. Okay, so we've spoken many times about Viktor Frankl. That's been a theme that we've used a lot. And his theory of logotherapy, which is explained in the book of Man's Search for Meaning. And the Man's Search for Meaning book also includes his experiences in the Holocaust and so on. And essentially, some of the highlights of that theory, as explained in the book, is number one, the concept of choice, that every person has a choice to be free or not. In other words, you can take away a person's freedom externally, but you can't take away his or her internal freedom, and that's the choice that he made during the Holocaust to feel free. The idea of having a reason to live, a why to live as he calls it, and that essentially everyone has an intrinsic need to live a life of meaning, right? So that's essentially, we've spoken about this many, many times. Now, what's interesting is that there's a lecture I gave a while ago, not on Thursday morning, but it was coming. There's a lecture I gave a while ago, and it was called Freud, Viktor Frankl, and Brené Brown. I don't know if you remember the lecture, right? So essentially what I thought about during that lecture was that modern psychology, beginning with Freud, has sort of three periods to it, right? The first was Freud, who is considered the father of modern psychology, but got it wrong in many things, as we know, but essentially came up with a theory that man, the human being at its core, is just a lust-seeking individual, a lust-seeking monkey, which is moderated by, you know, the ego, the uber-ego, and so on and so forth. And then came Viktor Frankl, who said, no, the person is intrinsically good, and in fact, there's a spark or a soul, where it's called in different places, and it has a basic drive and a need to live actually a life of purpose and meaning. It's not just a pleasure-seeking person, but actually it's really a person that seeks meaning, and therefore framed or reframed the whole psychological approach completely differently the way it was understood in Freud's times. And he ushered in a very, very important period of different types of psychological perspectives that were all based on positivity, we'll talk about this in a minute, and meaning and purpose and so on. And then, I think we've gone away from Freud again, from Viktor Frankl's model, and the world has become much more sort of self-centered and much more pleasure-seeking and I-centered kind of thing, right? So that's a theory I've had for a long time, but what I didn't realize is that much of the Viktor Frankl theory was actually a response. And this comes out because I've recently discovered lots of other material from Viktor Frankl, not just Man's Search for Meaning, including this book, which is called Embracing Hope, which is four essays or interviews that they have with Viktor Frankl. There's also a lot of other material, a lot of YouTube interviews with him. And what comes out is actually that his theory was really a response to what he saw before In other words, what he saw, as he calls it, the decline of society, in terms of, he saw a society, which we'll see in his interview how he describes it, but he saw a society of lack of meaning, lack of purpose, lack of responsibility, lack of direction, lack of the ability to be uncomfortable. And he was very, very disturbed by that, and he said it wasn't working. And therefore he introduced a new era, which is with amazing success, actually, right? Which was the man's search for meaning and logotherapy, all bringing back the concept of values and purpose. So that resulted in things like positive psychology, the research that happened on real happiness, what happiness really means, personal responsibility and choice, focusing on what you can do rather than what you can't do, all that kind of stuff. The model of seven habits was very much based on Viktor Frankl's model, proactivity, that you actually have a choice in how you respond to anything that happens around you. And then, of course, more recently, the Edith Eger two books, The Choice and The Gift, right? And then, as I said before, society moved away from all of that. And we entered once again into an era of lack of meaning, lack of value, lack of responsibility, self-absorption, the I world, narcissism, and so on, as we've explained many times. But what I found fascinating is this, right? If I look at some of the way he describes the world that he was responding to, the society that he was responding to is the same society that's now, just on steroids. Right? It's just gone completely crazy. But it's the same concept, the same problem. And it's fascinating how he fought that problem by producing a whole another set of values, but it's another set of values that requires work. It requires choice and requires responsibility. And then somehow, for all sorts of reasons, I guess, we slip back into the society that actually he was responding to, which is quite, I found that very, very fascinating. I didn't realize that till now. And therefore, I think it's worth looking at the society that he was complaining about and comparing it with our world to sort of get some perspective and get some understanding and maybe sort of explore and think about what we can do about it. Okay. So the part that I'm going to base today's on, but I'm also going to share a lot of what I experienced in Israel because I think it's directly related, is this book, as I said, Embracing Hope. It's the second chapter in the book, which is an interview. So I'll just give you a bit of context. So it was an interview by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in 1977. There was a television show called Man Alive, and the interviewer was Roy Bonnesteel or something. And he begins the interview with the following. He says to Viktor Frankl, a lot of interesting points here, which I'm going to go through some of it. And he begins with the following. He says, "Dr. Frankl, you spent 3 years in the 4 concentration camps during the war. Can you describe to me how you found meaning in life, how you found life worthwhile after that kind of experience?" So Frankl responds with an interesting thing. First of all, he makes just for clarification. He says, he complains that his American publishers circulated a story that he had come out of Auschwitz with a new brand of psychotherapy called logotherapy, right? And he says that's a fundamental mistake. But that's actually not what happened. Viktor Frankl, as we know, he writes about it in his Man's Search for Meaning, he entered the camps. In fact, he took a very long manuscript that he hid with him while he was in the concentration camp. He began that theory of logotherapy before the war. He lectured about it in university in Vienna before the war, right? So he said that what actually happens is that what happened to him was that the experience that he had in the camps was actually a testing ground for his theory. It wasn't something that gave birth to the theory. It was more of a testing ground to the theory, right? And he says it was concentration camp itself was serving, functioning in a sense, merely as a testing ground to confirm experientially and experimentally the justification for my conviction. Now, why is that? Because he says the following, and he says something very sharp and actually needs to be understood, I think. Because he talks about those that survived and those that didn't survive. Now, first of all, I'm just quoting him. I wouldn't say it myself, but he says it. But also, he's obviously referring not to people who were killed in the concentration camp because they didn't have a choice at all. There was selection and people were taken away and gassed, right? So, I mean, there's nothing to do with what meaning they have or didn't meaning they didn't have, whatever the case was. But he's talking about the people, I think, that were in the camps and were alive in the camps, right? And their willingness to keep going and the willingness to keep living, right? And he submits the following theory, right? He says that people who are orientated towards a meaning to be fulfilled by them in the future were more likely to survive. This is his theory, right? And he talks about this in Man's Search for Meaning. And he says he says the following. He says the question was not just survival, but there had to be a why of survival. He talks about it himself, actually, his experiences in the camp. This is Man's Search for Meaning, about in the camps how he would imagine himself in front of a classroom, imagine himself teaching, imagine himself sharing information, and the kind of helped him to keep going, right? In other words, he says the question of survival is for what? Unless there was something or someone, because what meaning means, by the way, that we'll talk about maybe next time. When he talks about you have to have meaning, meaning can mean different things. But he says you have to have a why or a what to survive for, something or someone, a personal cause, for whose sake to survive, that survival was scarcely possible, right? So he says that his experiences there just served as a confirmation for his conviction that a person can really only live properly and in very, very negative context can only survive if there's a why to survive or for what to survive for, right? You know, one of the people I always think about when I read this, and I've shared this with you before, is a great Hasidic Rebbe called the Kloisenberger Rebbe. I've talked about this before. I just recently read a whole book about him. That's why it's a person I'm very fascinated about. He, I think I've told this before, he was a great Hasidic Rebbe before the war, a great Torah scholar, and he had a wife and 11 children who he lost all of them in the war, right? In fact, there was one son that survived that died right after the war. And but he was a person with just absolute direction and purpose. He just, already in the DP camps, he right away jumped in. I mean, he suffered tremendously in the war, right? But right away, the DP camps right away began seeing how he could help people, how he could teach people. He set up a cheder. He started helping people physically, financially, amazing stuff, right? And rebuilt. He rebuilt a very big Hasidic dynasty in America and in Israel, two great groups. And then he also built a very, very big hospital called the Leonardo Hospital in Netanya. And that came from a promise that he had made during the war, that if he survives, he's going to build a hospital. But he saw what was done to people, and he built this amazing hospital afterwards. I mean, he didn't build it. He oversaw it and fundraised for it and so on. And for a time, he landed up living in Israel permanently towards the end of his life. But until that time, he would go up and down from America to Israel because he really had two communities. And when the first baby was born in the maternity unit in the Leonardo Hospital, he was in America. And so they called him to America that he should hear the baby cry. And when he heard the baby cry, he said, "That's my revenge." Right? That was his whole thing. So it's an amazing person who survived and then thrived on purpose, even though he lost so much, but he rebuilt, right? So this is his theory. His theory is that you, in order to live, in order to survive, in order to positively survive, when I say live, is not just exist, but actually to live properly, what's essential, as he says, and we'll come back to the interview in a moment, but is that there has to be a what for, there has to be a why, there has to be a purpose, there has to be a reason, a goal to live for. So in the last week, and I want to share with you some experiences, last week I saw this so clearly and so with such abundant clarity, really, in Israel, right? Which, by the way, Israel remains, I think, the sixth or the seventh, something like that, the most happiest country in the world, even after the war. Before the war was number four, I think. You can't blame them for downgrading just a little bit, but they're still up there, right? It's an incredible thing. I mean, it's the craziest thing. You see it when you're there. You see, like, the people are just alive, enjoying life. The restaurants are full. I mean, it's mad. But what is it? I've shared this with you before, but it wasn't, I didn't see it. It's different. When you see it and you experience it, it's completely different, right? Because over the last year and a half, people over here were often asking me about how does one go on? How does one not become despondent? How do you not become depressed? How do you keep functioning? How do you stay focused? And all that, and so on and so forth, right? And one of the things I've shared with some of you is let's have a look at the videos and at some of the information coming out of the people who are actually experiencing the pain firsthand. So I said that based on things that I was looking at and seeing, but not that I experienced. Now it's so much more clearer to me. But I want to give you a bit of a context for that, right? Because it's important to understand, and this is what I discovered there so deeply. Some of you have been there, so you know what I'm talking about. The country, when I say they're living there and they're going to restaurants and they're rebuilding and they're doing amazing things, it's not because they're in denial. They're actually not in denial at all. The pain is very real, and they're not afraid to share the pain and the challenges and the tests and all the things that they're experiencing. In fact, we had the most incredible speakers at different points that were not just tour guides. They were speaking emotionally from the heart and bringing us into the pain. I got to tell you, some of the days actually were very tough. Because they were very good at actually making you connected to their experience, which was incredible. So this was both in the south. We were near Oz. Near Oz is, what should I tell you, it's shocking. It's, you know, where we were at the Bibas home. It's really dark. It's really, really, really painful. Army bases, you know, up north in places that were evacuated, which is a whole nother interesting section. Like, you know, we talk about soldiers a lot. We talk about fallen soldiers, unfortunately, tragically, wounded soldiers maybe, but we don't talk about some of the other challenges. And for example, this Kiryat Shmona that we were is a town that was evacuated right after October 7th, because they were very afraid that Hezbollah was going to join the war right away, which they did eventually. They didn't, miraculously, they didn't in the beginning, actually. But we had a guy explain to us when we went into some houses that were hit by missiles and completely destroyed. Just a bit of humor. Israel operates different rules than the rest of the world. It's like really interesting. So I came to this house where like the missile had hit, right? And the whole house was destroyed, burnt and everything. So, you know, in Australia, you wouldn't be able to go in there. It would be cordoned off and OHS and this, that, and this regulation, that regulation. In Israel, no problem. You can go through just one announcement he makes before. When you go in, just be a little bit careful because there's some things on the floor. You go in, there's not things on the floor. The place is destroyed. There's wires all over the place. There's rubble. There's stones. There's broken stairs. Just be a bit careful. It's fine. Right? That's how Israel works. But anyway, but it's really painful to see. And he explained, he gave a brilliant lecture on explaining exactly how that whole challenge works. A whole community evacuated to hotels across the country, not knowing for how long. They thought it was for a few weeks. And it just officially ended just a few weeks ago. So, I mean, they were there like... now there's a whole challenge of getting them back. I mean, the financial impact, the living in hotels that didn't have laundry, so they have to make a whole fund to buy them washing machines. I mean, it's unbelievable, right? And now it's a whole question about them coming back. Some of them don't want to come back. Some of them don't want to come back now because the kids are settled in school. And it's only in August or something, or September, that the school year ends. And what that does to the whole infrastructure and the factories and the agriculture, it's huge, right? I'm just describing, I mean, the pain is real there. We visited, so I'll just share with you briefly. I'm not going to share with you all the details because it's not for now. But we went to Shura. I don't know if anyone has been to a place called Shura. Shura is an army base, which is the rabbinical army base of Sahal, of the Raviyev, but also serves as a where all the bodies come to be identified. And after October 7th, it's normally only for soldiers, but after October 7th, because there was no other way to do it, all the civilians came there. I mean, just imagine, right? He went through this most amazing, most amazing rabbi who's been involved with this young guy, Torah, a bit of a Torah scholar, but the most amazingly sensitive, beautiful person. And he took us through, step by step, exactly what all that looked like and what the process is, right? And after all that, it remains one of the happiest countries on earth. Why? Because, and each speaker would end like that. They'd bring us into the pain, and then like talk about rebuilding and bringing people back and rebuilding near Oz and rebuilding cities and coming back and so on and so forth, right? And, oh gosh, I hope that doesn't mess up the recording. Okay, 1 second. So, that's good. So, and I was thinking like this incredible paradox of the living with it. Like the pain is real, not shy, not in denial, but yet they're so driven with faith, with hope, with positivity. Because what I picked up there, and this became the theme of every different experience we had, there were different people, some more religious, some secular, but all of them, in their own way, fell into one theme. And the theme is that there's an amazing sense of purpose there. An amazing sense of purpose. An incredible why. There's a why. What for? What, right? On all levels. It's amazing. And that amazing sense of purpose to rebuild, to reconnect to Jewishness in many, many places. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but there's been an unbelievable awakening of the soul. Besides the physical rebuilding the land and protecting the land and preserving the connections of the land and so on, there's been the most incredible resurgence. I mean, just the, like I spoke to completely secular Chayalim, they're talking about emunah and faith and it's going to be okay and we're going to win. And even on a practical level, there's been thousands. I don't know why this particular mitzvah, but thousands of male soldiers have started to wear tzitzit. In fact, there was this amazing things of volunteers. They couldn't produce them quick enough. Tefillin has been an amazing. Even this guy at Shura told us that one of the things they've been doing is trying to get hundreds and hundreds of pairs of tefillin for soldiers who have taken upon themselves to put on tefillin every day, just for a minute even. But to, right, an amazing thing. And then there's this concept of it's going to be okay. It's our land. We here, you know, it's just with an amazing joy and amazing determination and conviction. Because it is exactly what Viktor Frankl is talking about. It's that sense of purpose. When you live with a purpose, it's a whole nother ballgame. When you live with a real goal of where you're off to, where you're headed, what you need to do, on whatever level it is, it's a whole nother way of life. And what happens is you can then live with a crazy combination or a contradiction. It's a complete paradox there. I think I've probably put this in some of the posts that I made, so you probably know this already, but we had one night a speaker was a UIA sponsored us a dinner, and in Jerusalem in a restaurant, and it was actually very, that was the day we went to Shura, and it was like a very heavy day, but then we ended off with this thing, and we had one of the speakers, the people that worked for them, and a woman, and she said this line which I think summed it up all. She said, "Over here in Israel, we are broken, but we are unbreakable." And that's exactly what it is. We are broken, but we are unbreakable. Right. On the way back, I'm skipping around a little bit, but on the way back at the night that I left, I didn't realize, I forgot over there how it works. The airport is open 24/7. I mean, actually not on Shabbos, but actually it's a whole night, right? So I asked, when I arranged the ticket, my return ticket, I said I want to come back on the 11th of May. So whoever took care of my ticket made it for 11th of May. It just happened to be 5 to 1 in the morning. So I thought, that's great, Sunday, 11th of May. Well, there was Sunday, 11th of May, technically speaking. So we were in for Shabbat. We were in Alon Shvut, if you know that, the Gush Etzion, right, between Hebron and Yerushalayim. So I had to leave right away. We called a taxi. Taxi rolls up. It's Israel, you know, like he's a guy from Yerushalayim. Get into the car, a Sephardic Jew. Make myself comfortable. We're traveling for about 10 minutes, and he turns to me. It's too quiet for the Israelis. All right. So he turns to me. He says, "No, maybe Harav, maybe the rabbi will say something about the parsha we learned today." I don't know. The guy picks me up in the Uber here. Doesn't do that. But right. So I said, sure. So we had a bit of a discussion on the parsha of the week, last week's parsha. And he shared with me a thought that he had. It was beautiful. Anyway, then we keep driving. And I thought to myself, you know, here's my opportunity. I want to talk to like a regular guy, not a soldier, not a rabbi, not a, I don't know, whatever, not a guy who's in near Oz in the south rebuilding a city or taking care of the evacuation. Which a regular guy in Israel. Let me see what he feels. So I said to him, Tagidli, I told him, tell me, how's Israel? He says, Nehadar, it's beautiful, it's amazing. Then he pauses and he says, Yesh bayot, there are problems. they're not shy of the problems, right? There are problems, there's this, there's that, but it's unbelievable, right? Why? Because I'm saying it's purpose, all about purpose, right? So, and not only, it's not only purpose with the will and determination to keep living, it's purpose with joy, like unbelievable joy and upliftedness, and it's just incredible, right? I'll just share with you a couple of interesting things. So, we went to Hebron. I don't know how many of you have been to Hebron lately, but it's a beautiful holy city. It's a place where our patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. It's got it's the place, incidentally, about talking about our connection to the land of Israel, it's the place 4,000 years ago that the first actual purchase of the land of Israel was made. You know that, right? Abraham purchased the land to bury Sarah. Also happens to be one of the highly contested pieces of land, but But it is ours. We bought it. It's a you know, besides the promise from God that the whole of Israel belonged to us, but it was actually purchased by Abraham. And many, many years ago, in one of the agreements, most of Hebron was given back to the Arabs. It was given up, land for peace, unfortunately. And 20% was left with the Jewish Jewish people. But in that 20%, it's 80% Arab, even in the Jewish section, right? And there are certain people who are dedicated to ownership of the land and the connection, the Jewish connection to the land, and they live there. And our tour guide was a guy called Simcha, I've forgotten his last name. Nice name, Simcha, joy. But that's his name. And he's been living there for 30 years. It is not comfortable to live in Hebron, I can promise you. First of all, for a long time he lives in a trailer, and then eventually got permission to build a house and all that kind of thing. But it's tense. It's very, very tense. And this guy is like, you think he's the happiest guy on earth. He's every day he's living with this mission and sharing the word and inspiring other people about our deep connection with the land of Israel. It's just incredible. And then there was a guy, just one of my favorite stories, one of my very experiences, it was just a beautiful moment. We went to an army base in the south where, I don't know, some of you might know him, there's a Australian guy, a Sydney guy called Ari Briggs. Yeah, you know him, of course. Amazing guy. He spent one day with us. We went down south, he spent all day with us. He's an incredible person. And I say, all the people were just not, they weren't tour guides, they were just from the heart. But he got very, very involved in a couple of projects. One of the projects he got very involved in is one of the things that happened on October 7th was the army, you know, army personnel weren't terribly around at the time. And the yeshuvim or the kibbutzim, by the way, I don't know the difference between a kibbutz and a moshav and a yeshuv. There is a difference, but I'm not sure exactly what it is. But the places where the people lived, they were very under-resourced. They didn't have enough guns, they didn't have enough people who could respond and fight back. And as a result of that, now there's a huge campaign to train first responders. So the army's working with civilians, and Ari's very, very involved in this. And he took us to this army base where they're actually training. We actually watched some of the training. They made us put earplugs because they were actually shooting, you know, it's like a shooting range. At cardboard models, whatever, and they were training to have more ammunition, also to be more trained first responders. Just God forbid, in case something happens. And then afterwards, a guy called Yiftach spoke to us. Yiftach and his brother. He has a brother called Elad. He was also there. He's a civilian, very involved in this program. He was from a place called Ein Mapsor, one of the kibbutzim there or something. And he told us the story of what happened for him October 7th. Him and his brother and others were miraculously saved. But they had nothing to fight with. But they all ran. A whole bunch of them ran. A whole bunch of men ran to the gate of the yeshuv. They were trying to close it remotely, but somehow the terrorists had already somehow managed to put something there that would be hard to close. Anyway, miraculously they were able to close it, but there was fighting. But they had nothing to fight with. He tells the story that he picked up a rock. He's going to go fight with a rock. Right? And he sees a friend of his running with an axe. And he says to his friend, what are you going to do with the axe? His friend said, what are you going to do with the rock? Right? Anyway, they went there. His brother got wounded, but thank God he's okay now. And he's telling this whole story and then how they're rebuilding now and how they're going to train first responders. Mitkolanim, they call it there. The whole thing. And as he's talking, I'm looking at him and he's got a life. He's a medical researcher. This is not his main thing. He does medical research. He's a scientist. From what I could see, a completely secular person. Meaning not particularly religious, as most of them were down south. And he's talking with such joy and with such positivity, like he's got a smile on his face. And he's telling us an experience which, for anyone, would be usually traumatic, right? And by the way, there is trauma there. There is PTSD there. It's all there. But he's just talking with such, like... And I was very fascinated. And I don't like to... On these trips, I don't like to ask questions in public. I like to let the person speak so I can listen. So I didn't say anything. But afterwards, when we were just milling around, I walked up to him and I said, do you mind if I ask you a question? And he said, sure. And I said to him, how do you stay so positive? Like, how are you so upbeat? How are you so positive? He looks at me like he doesn't understand what I'm asking. And he says, what do you mean? We're Jewish. He says, it's the Jewish spirit. Right? It's the Jewish spirit, tells me. He says, you know, my parents were Holocaust survivors. They did it. They rebuilt. They came. We've done this before. We're going to keep doing it. This is what God wants. This is our purpose. This is our focus. Exactly what I thought he was going to say. I mean, what I expected, right? But it was incredible. Just like, this is, what do you mean? We're driven. We've got a destination. You know, it's interesting that when the Jews left Egypt, and, you know, the purpose of leaving Egypt, we've talked about this before, was to go towards Mount Sinai and become God's nation when the Torah was given, right? And in the middle, they came to the Red Sea, and the Red Sea was there in front of them. And then they realized that the Egyptians are pursuing them from the back, right? Which is a huge challenge. And they started to panic. And the Midrash says they broke into four groups, different opinions. This one said we should go back to Egypt. The one said we jump into the sea. This one said we should pray. We should do this or that. Mayhem, chaos, right? And then God, the Chumash tells us this. The Torah tells us this. God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, they're all wrong. Just tell them they have a goal. Keep going. Just keep going towards your goal. Now, at the time, it made no sense because there was a sea there. There was an ocean there, right? And an individual, the Talmud says, called Nachshon ben Aminadav, he was the leader of the tribe of Yehuda. He said, well, God says, keep going. That's what we do. And he jumped into the ocean and he kept going. And as the water reached his neck, the sea split. Right? And it's always used as a model. We have a lot of challenges in life. And we get caught up by the challenges. And we get defined by the challenges. And we start panicking because of the challenges, right? And this is a whole different reframing of the whole story. The challenges are there because you're dealing with them. They're real and they're painful. But your focus has to be, what's the goal? What's your destination? When you keep your focus on the destination, the challenges shift. They move to a side. They let you go through. They might even still be there at some level, but they allow you to keep going, right? And that's kind of the message that we kept on hearing. I'm going to come back to this in a minute, but I want to just go back to the interview a little bit, because there's a very, very powerful point. And the interviewer, Bonnesteel, whatever, says to him the following. He says, you know, most of us have never been in a concentration camp experience. We've never had to go through the horror and tragedy. And so one would think that today it would be easier to find meaning in life. And yet I sense that it's more difficult in a sense today than it was in years past. Do you think that? He asks Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl answers, you're absolutely right. To which the interviewer says, why is that? And look, listen to what Frankl says. This is, I don't know, 1977, right? He says, because we are living in a society, either in terms of an affluent society or in terms of a welfare state, as we are in Austria, that's where he lived. Anyway, these types of societies virtually satisfy, or at least they are apt to satisfy and gratify each and every human need except for one need, the most basic and fundamental need to up that need, which is important for the person, the need for meaning. Consumer societies, they're even creating needs, but the need for meaning, or as I call it, the will to meaning, remains unfulfilled. It is now what I now call the unheard cry for meaning, right? So it's counterintuitive. In other words, specifically when it should be easier to find meaning, specifically when it should be easier to live with a life of purpose and direction, it actually becomes harder, because it's a society that gives us all the needs that we want, and yet it clouds or camouflages the need for meaning, because we're running after all other needs either that we've created for ourselves or that society has created for us, right? In the consumer society. You know, I just want to pause with this for a moment, because tonight is actually a very special night in the Jewish calendar, tonight and tomorrow. It's Lag BaOmer. And Lag BaOmer is connected to two unbelievably great sages of the Talmud, a teacher and a student, who then became also great sage in his own right. And I'm talking about Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's buried in Meiron, right? Rabbi Akiva was known as the leading sage of, in halachic terms, of the Talmud, an unbelievable Torah scholar. In a very tough time, he was responsible for actually the emergence of what we call today the oral Torah and the scholarship of the Talmud and so on. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is credited later on he's the author of the Zohar, and he's really the one who started the journey of the dissemination of the mysticism of Torah, right? But if we look at their lives, we'll see that they lived terrible, terrible lives. So Rabbi Akiva, first of all, lost 24,000 students, the famous thing. That's why we mourn during this period of time. And Lag BaOmer, they stopped dying. And he was tortured by the Romans, and he was under Roman regime, and was prohibited to operate as a religious person and to learn Torah. Amazing. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the same thing. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was actually forced into a cave with his son for 12, actually 13 years. It was 12 years, and then he went back for one extra year. Yeah, that's right. And both of them produced unimaginable levels of scholarship and Jewish wisdom, right? And we find that throughout Jewish history. It's specifically the times that were tough that seemed to produce the greatest results. It's amazing, right? Because Rav Shimon Chai, when he was in the cave, it didn't bother him. I mean, it did bother him. It was a very, very painful experience. In fact, when he came out after 13 years, the Talmud says how describes how unhealthy he was physically. But yet, his life was for a different thing. He didn't have any needs because there wasn't anything to get. So therefore, he was completely focused on his values and of learning and producing. And that was the focus. And that purpose kept them going and kept them driving, and they produced the most amazing things. So it's the sort of same point a little bit that Viktor Frankl is making. And then he says, I'll just quote for you two more quotes because it's beautiful. He says, and if there's a meaning to fulfill, this is a very, very important point. He says, if there's a meaning, in other words, if a person has meaning, right? If he's aware, if he becomes cognizant of such a meaning, then he's ready to suffer. He's ready to offer sacrifices. He's ready to undergo tension, stress, or so forth without any harm being done to his health. In other words, the need to live for meaning and purpose, right? The need to live for something higher results in the ability to be uncomfortable and to make sacrifices. It's a very interesting thing, right? And I think this is what you see now, right? Because I said, now we just have the same society as pre-Viktor Frankl, but just on steroids. One of the things we see besides self-absorption today and pleasure-seeking and lack of meaning and lack of purpose is the complete inability to be uncomfortable. People find it very difficult to be uncomfortable. Everything's stress and everything's trauma and everything's, I mean, not trauma, this is real, by the way, but it's been overused and over, right? And that's why there's so much anxiety, as we talked about before. And it's skyrocketed. Why? Because people are scared for things not to go well. People are scared for things not to go wrong because it doesn't fit into the life of comfort, doesn't fit into the life of pleasure seeking, doesn't fit into that life of personal needs, right? And that's such an important concept. And I'm going to go back to Israel in a second. And he says, even in another question he answers, he says, even, I don't know who this person is, but even Hans Seel, a man in Montreal, who created the concept of stress. Do you know that? Stress is a very new phenomenon, apparently. No, I mean the definition of stress, right? Recently has published a paper in which he says, stress is the salt of life. Man needs tension. I would say more cautiously, that what he needs is a sound amount of tension. Not too much tension, not too little tension, like salt, right? But a dosage, a solid, healthy source of tension. And later he says, it's well known among neurologists and psychiatrists that placing too high demands on people, listen to this, that placing too high demands on people is less dangerous than placing too few demands on them, right? People are today not over-demanded, they are under-demanded. Very, very interesting. Very interesting perspective, right? Because we are, like today, like, you know, with gentle parenting and all this other nonsense that goes on, it's like, be careful, don't overstress, don't overthink, they might fall apart, they might, who knows what, right? It's the opposite is true. Resilience comes from being uncomfortable. Now, again, I've said this millions of times, we don't pray to be uncomfortable. We don't pray to have challenges, particularly the challenges that Israel's going through. But the concept is there, right? The concept is that we always have to make some sacrifice for values. Some sacrifice for meaning and purpose doesn't come without hard work. Because any drive for meaning and purpose essentially comes from the concept of going beyond yourself, right? Purpose means you're living for something not you. You're living for something higher than you, other than you. That could be even in a relationship that could be like that. Also the same thing, right? Or for a higher purpose or for goals or for God or whatever the values are, it's something other than you. And going beyond you is never comfortable. That's the way it is. It's never comfortable. In order to really live for something else, you've got to make room for something else. To make room for something else means you have to give up some of you. Just the way it is. And if a person is very driven to always take care of themselves first and to make sure that they're perfectly comfortable in all levels and all contexts, you can't live for meaning and purpose because it's a contradiction. You've got to be able to give up some of yourself, on some level at least, to be able to live for a higher purpose, right? Coming back to Israel, I mean, this is something that is, again, you see that so much of there, the will and the determination and the and the understanding that sometimes to live for that goal and for purpose and to be driven in a sense of purpose means to have discomfort. Rabbi Doron Perez, who you've known and you've heard, spoke to us there as well. The trip that we had, it was a rabbinical council trip of New South Wales, but it was sponsored and organized by World Mizrahi, who Rabbi Doron Perez is one of the heads of World Mizrahi. And he spoke to us, and he spoke about the whole journey of Israel and living there. And he said this phrase, he said, it's a painful privilege. Because obviously, as you know, he personally went through tremendous pain, lost his son. Daniel, who they still don't have his body, they have something of him, some army uniform and some blood they were able to bury, but they don't really have his body yet. So it's a lot of pain there. And he talks about this paradox a lot as well. And the way he put it was, it's a painful privilege, but it's a privilege. In other words, they're happy about it. There's a optimism and a drive and upliftingness about fulfilling that mission, but it is painful sometimes. And that's how generally living for a purpose actually works, right? There's a guy who gave us a shiur on Shabbos. Actually, interesting, I have caught up to him after many, many years. His name is Rabbi Rafi Ostroff. We share a cousin, first of all, but I know him before that because when I grew up in Johannesburg, he lived around the corner. We were friends. Not him so much. His older brother was my age, but he's a little bit younger than me. But it was a nice meeting. Does a lot of good stuff. But interestingly enough, he's like 58, I think, now, and he did the army, and he was finished with the army already many times. Like, he's Milawim, his reserve duty, he's done. Like, he just volunteered. Like, he spent now 100 days serving. Volunteered. Left his family. Came back for Pesach, went back in, now he's out, and I think he's finished now, but like incredible. Just why? Because driven for the purpose. Right? On Shabbos, I want to tell you this beautiful story, so I think it's such an important story. On Shabbos, we were in a place called Alon Shvut. I think I told you this, right? Alon Shvut is in Gush Etzion. Gush Etzion is a municipality which has a bunch of different yeshivim, which was built after 67. But what I didn't know was that it wasn't built after 67. It has a long history. It's in Judea, right? That's where Jews lived, really. In fact, the connection to Gush Etzion is very deep and very long. In the Second Temple, 10 of the tribes of the Jewish people weren't there because they had already been exiled in the First Temple, right? So we're talking about 2,000, 2,500 years ago, the main community were people that came from the tribe of Yehuda and Binyamin, and a bit of Kohanim and Levim as well. And that's the Jewish community today. It comes from mainly those two tribes. And they lived in Judea and Samaria, right? That's where they lived, what they love to call the West Bank. I don't know what that means, but it's Israel, right? And it has a very long history of people that were settled there before, and then when the War of Independence came along, actually just before the day that they declared the State of Israel, Gush Etzion fell completely, and the women had already gone to Jerusalem, and the women and children, and the men were there holding out, and then basically that's the surrender last day, and the Arabs took them out and killed them all in this particular town. And we had a tour on Shabbos of this place, and the history is very beautiful, very amazing information. There's a tree there. It's called the Lone Tree, Ilan Boded. It's a very big oak tree. It's about 800 years old. In fact, now they're supporting it with different like metal poles and things like that. And the women and the children who survived, but had lost their husbands and fathers and so on, throughout the time from 1948 to 67, they were able, from the rooftops in Jerusalem, they were able to see this oak tree, right? And they would go up and look at the oak tree, and they would say, "Ze'a bayit shlanu, this is our home. We're going to come back." This is the mentality there, right? And after 67, with great difficulty, ongoing difficulty, I mean, it's an amazing place. I mean, this is the place where Avraham Avinu, who lived in Hebron, traveled through to when he took Isaac to the binding of Isaac. That's where he traveled. We went on a mirpeset. We had a tour of the yeshiva there on a porch. You could see all the Jewish yeshivim and the Arab towns and everything. And you could see also the place where the Hanukkah story took place. And in fact, recently they've archaeologically discovered arrowheads from the story of the Hanukkah. It's like amazing history there. Okay? Anyway, so we did different things. Just it was amazing to be there. But someone spoke to us at Shabbos afternoon. Her name, she's been here in Australia. Some of you might have heard her. Her name is Cheryl Sanders. I don't know if you've heard her, which was it. Shir Hussein has lost a son in the army, not in this war, in previous, he was on a mission to kill, they discovered that three terrorists were hiding somewhere, and they were going to go and get them, but then there was a lookout, and the terrorists got them first, and they killed them. Anyway, but, so she spoke to us, she's now over, she's an older woman, she's over 70, very, very funny person, very amazingly charismatic. She told us first her own personal story. She grew up with her husband, she grew up in Toronto, completely disconnected from Yiddishkeit at all. She never even, until she got married, her parents were a bit more traditional, she never even saw a Shabbos candle. She didn't know what it was. That's a little... Eventually, somehow, they got more involved in a community there and they embraced a bit more of Yiddishkeit and eventually became religious and they made Aliyah, they had a bunch of kids, and they made Aliyah too, and they settled in Alon Shvutz. And she told us her personal story. Anyway, she had a son called Daniel, obviously a very special boy. And he was the one that was killed in the army. And she talked to us about her own journey, how she overcame. At the beginning, of course, she was broken, as to be expected. But she knew she has to pull through, and she knew she has to... But it was she was finding it difficult. She told us a very freaky story. She actually had a dream, she told us, right? The second story is the one I really want to bring out, but I'll just tell you what she said. She had a dream that she saw a bunch of young people at a table having a really good time. And then she saw her son in the dream, but he was not a part of the table. He was standing nearby, and he was like looking very sad. And she ran over to him in the dream, and she hugged him, and she said to him, "Why aren't you joining in?" And he said to him, "It's unbelievable, it's like a freaky dream." He said to her, the reason I say it's unbelievably powerful, because actually this concept is written about in Jewish sources, this concept is written, but she dreamed it. And he said to her, "I can't be happy while you continue to be sad." That's what he said to her. So she realized that she must do something. Eventually she did. She worked through it. And she says, obviously, the pain never goes away, but she's in a whole different space now. And what keeps her going? What keeps her going is the following story. Listen to this. I'm bringing this out about the point I said before, that even though it's sometimes hard, but we have to be able to, for a purpose, we have to be able to carry things that are difficult, right? Story was that when her son was in the army and he finished training on the last day, they have this thing, this tekes, the ceremony, that on the last day, all the soldiers who were in that unit training, they go on this very, very long hike, carrying all the uniform and the backpack and the guns and everything. It's very difficult, but this is a sign that they finished the training, right? And apparently, for some reason, there's one extra piece of ammunition. I don't know what it's called exactly, a very heavy gun or something. Excuse me, that's like 8 kilos heavy or something, that they also give to someone to carry. But normally they choose like someone who's like the biggest and the tallest and the strongest of the whole group, that he has to carry an additional thing, right? An extra weight, yeah. So they gave it. There was one person that was eligible, and he was the one to pick it up. And they all started to run or walk very fast or run part of the way. I don't know exactly what it is. And suddenly this guy was carrying the extra piece of ammunition. He just collapsed. So her son, Daniel, ran over to this guy just to see if he's okay. And as he's just talking to him to see if he's okay, he hears the commander saying to him, his name was Daniel Sanders, he said to him, "Sanders, you pick up that piece." He looks at the commander and he thinks, "Like me? Like, I'm the shortest guy here, and I'm like, I mean, I've done the training, but I'm not exactly the strongest guy, you know what I mean?" And all the guys said to us, "Sanders, pick up the piece." In Hebrew he said it, right? So he did. The commander says, "So you do." So he picked it up, kept going, and got to the finish line, and became a soldier in the army. Later became a lieutenant, etc. So she said, this is what she said to us, it was very, very powerful. She said to, "I realized when I was reflecting on the story, and after this dream, that I'm also on a journey. Journey's called life. And sometimes you collapse. And sometimes there's things that need to be done that are difficult. And then there's the commander in chief," and she looks up and she says, "Hashem." Mm. And the commander in chief says, "Sanders, pick it up and move." And she says, "It's hard, but that's what you do. That's what you do." And she finished off, I'll just complete the story, she finished off, it was so like, cool. And she finished off and said, "As I finish now, I want to ask you to do two things." She asked us all, the rabbis and the rabbitsons. "I want you to do two things. First of all, I want you to sing two songs." So we had to sing for her. And one song is the famous Breslov line, Mitzvah gadola liyot b'simcha. You know the song? Mitzvah gadola liyot b'simcha. Which means it's a great mitzvah to be happy. That's what the song means, essentially. And it's made into a song, I don't know, a few years ago. So we sang and we danced. And then she wanted us to sing the song of Kola Olam Kulo, you know? Gesher, the whole world is a narrow bridge. V'ha'ikar lo lafached. The main thing is not to be afraid. We have a commanding in chief. He's telling us what to do. He's directing us. He has a plan. We don't always understand it. But that's what we need to do. So we sang that, and then she says, and the second thing I want you to do is you turn to her, she says, I want you to do a mitzvah for my son. Choose a mitzvah and do a special mitzvah for my son. So that was the message. It's hard, but the commanding chief says you gotta do it. There's a goal, there's a destination, there's a purpose. We have to be focused on it. So it also goes together with the, as I said before, the amazing deepening of Emunah. First day I got there, this is when you know you're in Israel. First day I got there, I got up early. I got there Sunday night, and then I was up. The program started Monday afternoon. I wanted to give myself half a day just to visit an uncle and do a few things. And I got there, and I was looking for a shul to daven early in the morning, and I see a bus going by. On the bus, there's this huge ad. Huge. And it says, for the pits, for the chayalim, and for the chatufim, which means for the soldiers and for the hostages, Omrim b'chol yom, we say every day, and in big letters, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. I said, now I'm in Israel. But that's the vibe there, right? People are... So, I just want to finish off very briefly with this following idea. What does it mean to us, right? I was thinking about it and reflecting on the way back. It's all very nice, it's nice stories, very inspiring, but what does it mean for us? And I think it means a few things. First of all, we don't want to invite challenge. The Lubavitcher Rebbe had a long essay, and he spoke about this once. He was contrasting the Jews living, the Hasidim, the Chabad Hasidim, living in Russia and they're living in America. And we know in Russia they had tremendous self-sacrifice to be Jewish, to do a mitzvah, to keep Shabbos, to put on tefillin, whatever, and they risked their lives, right, because they were under real attack from the communist regime. And he said, the idea is not to go back to that, but the idea is to learn how to do that when things are comfortable, right? Viktor Frankl said that when you live in an affluent society, it becomes harder. It is harder. But the point is to look at the people who are going through the challenge, and despite the challenge, or maybe because of the challenge, are just so driven with purpose, and to learn how to do that when things are going well. But things do need to go well. That's what we pray for. We don't pray for challenge, even though, of course, we all have a little bit of challenges, and we all have to have some sacrifice, but it's to learn how to be that determined with such conviction and positive when things are going fine, right? And I think that's the one thing that sort of struck me and I was thinking about. And the second thing is, we need to join the fight. As we've spoken about many, many times, but I think it's become so much clearer to me. They are amazingly connected to us as we are to them. They, when you tell them that we pray for them and that they're amazingly grateful, and we need to believe that it makes a difference. But I think that we need to do it like they're doing it. To volunteer to do it, to work hard to do it, sometimes be uncomfortable to do it. Not just once in a while to sing a nice song, make a mishaberach or something like that. That's all good. But actually to do something hard, like Sharon Mandel told us, do a mitzvah for my son. In other words, do something, learn something, pray something, even when it's not convenient, with the same determination, with the same sacrifice, with the same giving up a bit of comfort, believing that it really makes a difference. So it's the point I wanted to share from my Israel experiences a little bit, but and there's much more, but I wanted to bring out this point that Viktor Frankl makes, that it's really the sense of living with purpose that is so difficult today, because we don't live in that kind of society like he went through, Viktor Frankl went through, or like what they're going through now in Israel. But nevertheless, it's the only way to live. It's the only way to be positive. It's the only way to be focused on the future, be focused on what we're doing, on rebuilding, on spiritual connection, on deepening our Jewishness, all of that. And that's what brings true happiness and really keeps us going forward. We'll do some of the other stuff in the next few weeks. Part of that is also understanding what meaning really means and what different types of meaning it is. Have a wonderful day.